Greg gave a very nice introduction. I was considering talking about some of our work on motor axon guidance, which would have been complementary to Victor's. I also considered talking about some of our work on spinal cord circuitry and how locomotion is regulated. But in the end, I thought it might be very helpful if I could talk to you about some of our unpublished work that we've been doing on cell fate specification and trying to understand the function of transcription factors. And a couple of the important concepts that you'll want to remind yourself of from time to time if I'm forgetting to point them out are that the early developmental steps within the spinal cord are initiated by gradients. I'll show you a few examples of that in just a minute. But the point is that these gradients have to be converted into absolute values, and that is somewhat of a challenge in any situation, particularly a biological system, for how you would convert a smooth gradient into an absolute value. The other concept that you should probably be aware of right at the beginning is the notion that we're going to be talking about how multiple proteins come together to form higher order complexes, and that those higher order complexes are really the functional units that are driving cell differentiation. And what is important in these functional complexes is the relative stoichiometry of the components. So it's very important to get each of the parts produced at the proper levels. Otherwise, you start to generate complexes that don't have all the pieces and are not functional. And so hopefully I'll try and explain that a little bit better now. So since I'm going to back up and talk about steps a little bit earlier than the development of motor neurons and how they extend axons to various targets out on the periphery, I just wanted to show you what the early developmental steps of the neural tube look like, whereby the overlying, the primitive ectoderm of the embryo is converted into a so-called neural ectoderm. And that neural ectoderm then folds up, whereby the lateral, or what will eventually become the dorsal, portions of the neural tube fuse together to form a tube. So at this stage, if you can see it down here, at this particular stage, there are so-called neural epithelial cells within the neural tube. These are considered to be multipotential. In other words, they can take on many different cell fates. And what they're really doing at this particular time in development is monitoring their position within the embryo. And the way that they're doing that is through cell-to-cell interactions. And some of the important interactions that have been already identified within the embryo at this stage are interactions between the notochord, a structure located down here. This is what makes us vertebrates, is that we have a notochord when we're embryos. This is a source of very important signals that instruct the differentiation of cells that will form in the ventral or bottom portion of the neural tube. The overlying ectoderm up here is also the source of important signals for instructing the differentiation of cells in the top part of the neural tube. And then the somites on either side also are the source of signals that will further help to refine through cell-cell interactions the proper types of cells. So in this schematic, so as you go through development here in a chick embryo or a mouse embryo, this really only takes a few days, so it occurs at a relatively rapid time scale. In a human, it probably takes on the order of 6 weeks, if I had to estimate. At these particular stages, you begin to generate some of the postmitotic neurons, and these neurons have very specialized properties. As you just heard with motor neurons, they in fact all share common features in that they will grow axons out of the spinal cord, they'll be cholinergic, most of them will synapse with muscles, so they all share a lot of properties. You can further subdivide them depending on which targets they're going to grow toward, as Victor alluded to. But in addition to generating motor neurons, you also generate a lot of other spinal neuron types. So some of the cells from the dorsal neural tube will migrate out as part of the neural crest and form dorsal root ganglia. I didn't draw it over on this side, but it's shown here with neurofilament labeling. Ganglia that relay sensory information back into the neural tube. as well as a variety of spinal interneuron classes, the majority of which are probably inhibitory neurons that have complex, yet to be well-defined connections directly and indirectly onto motor neurons. And this circuitry, particularly within the ventral spinal cord, comes together to form what is called a central pattern generator, which can control simple movements like alternating stepping. So what I want to talk to you about are some of our efforts to understand how the identity of motor neurons versus some of the other ventral spinal cord cells are established, especially in light of the fact that the notochord is the source of a signal called sonic hedgehog, which is producing a gradient high at the point source here and tailing off away from it as you move up or dorsally here, and how that generates particular cells along this dorsal ventral axis of the neural tube. So this particular signaling, I have neglected to include this here, but the notochord would be underneath the neural tube. This is just half of a neural tube. And the notochord would be the source of a protein, a secreted protein called sonic hedgehog. And as I already said, the cells that are closest to the notochord are going to see the highest levels of sonic hedgehog, whereas the cells furthest away are going to see lower concentrations of sonic hedgehog. The reason that there are boxes here and circles here is that the sonic hedgehog is really acting primarily on the dividing neural epithelial cells. And as the neural tube begins to generate specific neuronal subtypes, these neuronal subtypes will migrate laterally. And so they arise from very specific domains, so-called progenitor cell domains, that are marked by unique combinations of transcription factors. So there's this medial to lateral process of differentiation that is taking place within the spinal cord. These cells are still undergoing cell divisions, but they already express unique combinations of these transcription factors as a consequence of the concentration of sonic hedgehog that they're seeing. But as these cells become postmitotic and begin to generate specific neuronal subtypes, they will activate different combinations of transcription factors. And so what I'm going to talk to you about today is our effort to understand some of the regulatory steps that occur from this progenitor cell stage to this postmitotic stage. And this is a stage when the cells are just at the point of becoming postmitotic, and we think is a critical phase in establishing the proper identity of the cell.
The gradient for the sonic hedgehog, how is that gradient established? Are there enzymes that destroy the sonic hedgehog, or just diffuse away?
Yeah, I think that the level that you would really want to know, I probably can't answer with any precision, but one of the ideas is that the receptor itself, the patch receptor on the surface of cells, is binding up the sonic hedgehog and, in effect, trapping it, so that that helps to create what is thought to be a kind of even distribution of the protein. Having said that, however, when antibodies against sonic hedgehog are used, it is extremely difficult to document a direct protein gradient. And the way that the gradient is most often assessed is through indirect methods. So Gli expression is one.
But are there enzymes that destroy it? Is that known? Somebody should know that.
I don't know that there are specific enzymes that destroy it. There are interacting proteins, so hedgehog interacting protein, which can affect neutralize it, and so they may be in some sort of counter gradient. But I don't know of any enzyme that is expressed in a counter gradient that would help to eliminate it.
Is the lipid modification of the sonic hedgehog can make the difference in making this a different cell type?
So the sonic hedgehog protein is processed. A cholesterol moiety is added to it. This helps to tether it to membranes and probably also helps, it certainly helps in increasing its activity, but may also help in its ability to establish a gradient. In terms of whether the processing itself occurs in a graded way, I don't think that's the case.
Is Sonic Hedgehog expressed in the single qubit at all?
Yes, later on, at much later stages, the motor neurons themselves will begin to express it. But one of the things that also occurs is that the floor plate, or rather the notochord, induces a structure within the neural tube, a glial structure called the floor plate, which shows up right here, and the floor plate will also begin to express Sonic Hedgehog.
So it's plausible that it's not diffusion, but just
the domino effect. Yeah. So that model has been pretty thoroughly tested, and it's clearly not Sonic Hedgehog being transferred to the next cell, and the next cell producing a new factor that triggers the next cell. It's really acting in a graded way, and a lot of that has been formally tested. And it's been done using by going right to the receptor for Sonic Hedgehog and tweaking its activity and showing that different levels of receptor activity can generate different types of neurons.
What I was thinking about is that the expression of Sonic Hedgehog in human cell will produce 90% expression in the next cell and then so on, right?
Yeah, it does. The Sonic Hedgehog does not spread up all the way through the neural tube, though. It stops at the floor plate.
Yeah, if you stain with an antibody, you see a spot at the bottom.
Yeah. In fact, I'm going to show this at the end, but if I can get out of this. If there's no gradient,
yeah,
I can't get all the way down there.
I think there's supposed to be a gradient.
There is,
you can see it.
Yeah, it's difficult to document at the level of...
Action at a distance.
I guess the question is...
Gradient, but you only see a spot.
The source.
So my question was more about diffusion versus expression. You know?
Yes. Well, the idea is that this isn't my data, so I'm happy to trash it. But other people's data argues pretty convincingly that from here upward, you don't have any cells that are producing the Sonic Hedgehog, and that in the extracellular space, that the level of Sonic Hedgehog is dropping off rather rapidly from being high here to low up there. But, you know, there's a lot of complex cell biology that may be at work here that we don't necessarily understand. So there's also a literature on ultra-fine cell processes called cytokines that might reach down and help to detect the Sonic Hedgehog as well. There's also a very complex involvement of cell cilia as a readout mechanism for detecting the Sonic Hedgehog. So I would say the issue is not settled, but it is pretty clear that Sonic Hedgehog is one of the key so-called patterning molecules, and that it can act in a concentration-dependent manner. And the outcome of that graded levels of Sonic Hedgehog are to produce absolute cell identities. So this is really the challenge that the neural tube, or almost any part of the developing embryo, is confronted with, is that cells are monitoring their position within the embryo. They're using, in often cases, they're using gradients or so-called morphogens, as the jargon goes in developmental biology. But they have to convert that into an absolute value. And the trick then is, what do you do when you're right at a threshold level, 1.2 nanomolar versus 1.3 nanomolar? How do you make that critical decision that I'm going to be a floor plate, or I'm going to produce this red class of cells that produce or express SIM1, a so-called V3 class of spinal interneurons? So that's the trick that the system has to resolve. And so one of the mechanisms that has been identified for resolving that is to initiate the expression of different transcription factors as listed here, but many of these transcription factors act negatively, analogous to the way you've heard about axon guidance and the Fs, and that these transcription factors are incompatible with one another. So the thought is that if a cell begins to express, for example, Iroquois 3 and Olig 2, that both of those transcription factors are trying to repress the expression of each other. And what then is thought to occur is that a cell internal or intrinsic mechanism ensues, or battle ensues, whereby the cell that has a little bit more of one or the other is going to win out. And so this is thought to help in taking gradients and resolving them into absolute values. So within these so-called progenitor cells, so you have to recognize the fact that I've turned this on its side. So ventral here would be the bottom group, and the colors don't match up anymore. Sorry, this is completely useless. P3 here.
Red is green, right?
Red is green, yeah.
Red is green, blue is red.
I'm even
red
confused,
blue,
so.
So if we think about the competition between Olig 2 and IRS3, and in one cell, one wins, and the neighboring cell, the other one wins, but we still want to have a smooth boundary.
So there are likely slightly different adhesion properties as well, and these things juggle just a little bit so that the domains will sharpen up over time.
Right, so the transcription factors will very likely control genes that are involved in, receptors and ligands, for example, that are involved in setting up that boundary specifically.
Right.
So they will move then appropriately to what transcription factor one.
Yeah. So if you catch this at some of the intermediate stages, you can find rare instances of cells that express combinations of transcription factors that are known to be incompatible with one another. And if you look later in development, you never find them co-expressed. And also if you look very precisely at the boundary relationships between some of these cells, they tend to resolve into very accurate domains or almost like unique segments. And that's probably occurring by having the cells juggle a little bit at the boundaries in a way that's appropriate for the transcription code that they ultimately selected.
So the suppression can occur within the neighboring cells as well, or only within the cells?
Only within the cell. So these
in
factors
the cell,
are.
Basically, this translates very small differences into all or none over time, because the two things cross or press one another. So whoever is a little bit higher eventually will defeat the lower. Through rounds of RNA expression.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I understand that, but I mean, what is the mechanism which is responsible for the sharpening of the lower?
Well, it's got to be cell communication.
Right. Now. So you look at cell communication.
It's got differential adhesion.
Yeah, differential adhesion, right.
Yeah, this guy wins, he makes one set of transfer. He makes one set of
Can he get displaced?
Well, cells have all kinds of migratory properties. And so part of that is based on homophilic interactions. They want to be next to neighbors that have similar adhesion molecules.
And this tends to happen only over one or two cells.
Yeah, these are not great distances that these cells have to move.
Sam, somebody must have changed the Sonic Hedgehog expression in the floor plate. Can you talk about that?
No, I'm not.
Would you just say a second about it, what happens?
I don't know that it's been done in such a precise way that one could make a lot of interpretations about how these domains change. But as far as I know, the patterns of these domains shift in predictable ways. So as the levels of Sonic Hedgehog are increased or decreased, you see.
You squish the ones at one end. And
that's right.
And it's
that's
been
right.
done in other places in the nervous system, and probably a little more convincing. It's pretty clear. If you have more Sonic Hedgehog at a point source, then you basically
push ventral domains further, like in this case, it would push ventral domains further doors.
Yep. One further idea, I should probably stop while I'm ahead.
Peter always happens.
Peter was on his third introductory talk at 45 minutes. Third introductory slide at 45 minutes.
Okay. Jumping right ahead here. So I tried to make the argument that there's a lot of gene regulation that is occurring in these progenitor cells, but that we think that there's even a little bit of plasticity that goes on here. So this isn't an absolute dictum that you have to produce a particular neuronal subtype. We think that the decision is really made very close to the time when the cells decide to stop dividing. And so we've looked at a lot of the transcription factors that are become expressed right at this time point in their development and as they're moving laterally. And one of the families of genes that we've worked on is a family called the limb-homodomain transcription factors, of which there are 12 in you and me and mice, and they're expressed in unique combinations in different cell types within the embryonic spinal cord. They tend to be expressed, this isn't absolute, but many of them tend to be expressed as the cells are becoming post-mitotic. One of the interesting features of this family is that they can be mixed and matched, and so you can build higher levels or more complexity by mixing and matching various combinations here, and I'm going to talk a little bit about how that mixing and matching plays out in terms of protein interactions. So these proteins, this family of transcription factors, is really built to interact with other proteins, and they're built to interact with other proteins. The homodomain is for DNA binding, but the so-called limb domain is a zinc-coordinating cysteine-histidine-rich motif that forms these in a cartoon fashion, these loops. And these loops are able to interact with very high affinity with other proteins. So the idea here is that unique combinations of these contribute to the regulation of different cells. And so one example of a simple code that I'm going to show you is an example where a population of V2 interneurons, we've labeled these cells genetically in mice, by expressing a so-called tau MYC reporter under the control of LHX3, labels interneurons that will grow axons to the side of the spinal cord, the so-called ventrolateral funiculus. Then these run up and down the spinal cord, and we think they make direct and indirect connections with the motor neurons that are going to control muscle activity. Motor neurons express a combination of LHX3 together with another limb protein, islet 1. So we started thinking about, well, what's going on here? How does LHX3 in this context seem to control V2 interneuron differentiation, and in this context motor neuron differentiation? Why don't you run into a cross-regulatory problem? So we started doing gain-of-function experiments. We do these in chick embryos by misexpressing constructs that encode LHX3. We do it unilaterally so that one half of the neural tube receives expression constructs for LHX3. CHEX10 is a transcription factor that specifically marks this population of V2 interneurons. So this is the endogenous population of V2 interneurons on either side of the spinal cord. This is where we've ectopically expressed LHX3 and triggered the ectopic differentiation of V2 interneurons. Now, if I have enough time, I'm going to come on to the notion that you can subdivide V2 interneurons into an A class and a B class. But for now, we're going to talk about them as a whole population, V2 interneurons. What we found in these gain-of-function experiments is that if you simply add islet 1 expression constructs together with LHX3, that you can trigger motor neurons to ectopically form, which will express the transcription factor marker HB9. And I don't have the control here, but the addition of islet 1 completely suppresses the ability of LHX3 to trigger any of these interneurons. So islet 1 is an important gatekeeper on the function of LHX3 and completely switches it from an interneuron factor to a motor neuron factor. And we became interested in how that switch occurs. And the solution to this really comes through beginning to understand some of the protein interactions that are mediated by the limb domains of the limb transcription factors and beginning to think about the higher order complexes that are formed. So what I need to tell you is that limb factors interact with very high affinity to a cofactor that is ubiquitously expressed in cells, or nearly ubiquitously. And this cofactor, we call it nuclear limb interactor, or NLI. And so the end of NLI, this orange bit, interacts with very high affinity to limb domains. All limb domains, or all of the limb transcription factors, will bind to this. So this is a protein interaction assay, and we can show that LHX3 will pull down NLI, and in this particular assay it works the other way around as well. In the course of doing these experiments, one of the postdocs working on the project decided to do a control, and this was supposed to be a negative interaction, asking whether one limb factor would bind to the other limb factor. And to our surprise, we found an interaction occurred. So while this was supposed to be negative, it turned out to be a strong positive, and we mapped the interaction such that the limb domain of LHX3 interacts with the very end part of the islet 1 protein. And it's very specific to the limb domains of LHX3. If we take the limb domains of other limb factors like limb 1, shown here in gray, and fuse it onto the homing domain of LHX3, we don't see any interaction. So there's something special about the limb domains of LHX3 that allow it to interact with islet 1. So through a long series of structure function experiments that I'm not going to drag you through, we believe that the relevant complex that is involved and is necessary and sufficient for generating V2 interneurons is something that, in a cartoon fashion, looks like this, whereby the NLI can self-dimerize, this red domain can self-interact, and that it recruits two molecules of LHX3 by virtue of the limb domain binding to the C-terminal end of NLI, and that this is, the homing domains here in purple are what sit down on DNA elements. And we've begun to identify some of those DNA elements and their palindromic sequences, as you might expect, based on this configuration of the factors. So what is going on in motor neurons? Well, I know I went through the protein interaction data pretty quickly, but both the limb domains of islet 1 and LHX3 are able to bind to NLI. So we think that in the absence of islet 1, this is the complex that forms, but when you begin to produce high levels of islet 1, as you do in motor neurons, a competition begins to occur in which the islet 1 displaces the LHX3, and because there's a binding site on the C-terminal end of islet 1, you can form this sort of complex. So by displacing LHX3 and offering it another sink, that you can generate a hexameric complex that looks something like this. So we've done a variety of structure function experiments to, I think, fairly convincingly establish that this complex is the relevant one for triggering motor neuron differentiation. And so one of the kinds of experiments that you can do is to take the red domain for dimerization from NLI, the homing domain of islet 1, and link it to the homing domain of LHX3. So three bits of or bits of three different molecules in a chimeric protein that will self-dimerize, and that is sufficient to generate motor neurons. And if you do the same over here, the red bit of NLI for dimerization and the DNA binding bit, the homing domain of LHX3, fuse them together, that's sufficient to generate V2 interneurons.
So do you find coupled site binding sites for islets 2 and LHX3?
So yes, we have identified cis elements. There's some similarity to the element that is recognized here, but there are also a lot of differences. So this DNA binding element is big. It's about 14 nucleotides, and some of the specificity we think that LHX3 has for DNA is altered somehow by this protein interaction. So there's a paper in the pipeline, which I've yet to look at very carefully, but has begun to do crystal structures of this complex. So hopefully within the next year, we'll begin to get some clues about the conformational changes that occur from this complex to this complex that might account for the differences in DNA binding specificity. But you're on to a very important point that I should have probably emphasized. This complex recognizes a completely different set of sequences than this one. So it's not as if this one regulates all of the genes that this one does, plus perhaps a few extra. They're really different target sequences that are...
And do you really need LHX3 electrics three to trigger motor neuron.
Yes, without it, you do not generate.
You need a very bending size on the cards.
Yes, for spinal motor neurons, that's the case. Yeah. One last point here. So in this cartoon diagram, what should be apparent to you is that we've made some pretty strong arguments or implied that the ratio of these factors must be, in this case, a 1-to-1 ratio of NLI to LHX3. And in this ratio, all of the components must be pretty similar in concentration to one another. And you could imagine, for example, if you massively upregulated the levels of NLI, that you'd begin to generate a lot of, I didn't draw it, so I have to do it this way. You generate a lot of complexes that have NLI bound on one side without any limb factors, and then maybe some of the limb factors on the other side. And again, through structure function work, we know that these kinds of half complexes are not functional. So we believe that there must be a pretty tight regulation of these components in order to set these complexes up properly. And part of that is from a rich history of working on this class of transcription factors in invertebrates like flies and worms. So one of my colleagues at the Salk Institute, John Thomas, has shown pretty convincingly that if you take the fly homolog of this protein and either mutate it or overexpress it, that you will get the same phenotypes in flies. And it's presumably because you don't build up these complexes in quite the right stoichiometries. So we wanted to test this in mice. We wanted to use genetics to do that. So this is a project that was taken on by Myeong Song when she was a postdoctoral fellow in my group. One of the challenges, however, is that when we mutate islet 1, what begins to happen to the cells is that they just die right when they should become motor neurons. And so we had to devise a fairly convoluted strategy to circumvent the cell death issue so that we could actually look at what was going on with cell fate. And what she did is collaborated with some colleagues over at UCSD who had generated an integration into the islet 1 gene in collaboration with us, that in one case inserted a cassette into one of the introns, and this cassette we call a hypomorph because it begins to interfere with the normal expression of islet 1. And then when we use DNA recombinase, flip recombinase, to eliminate this cassette, we are left with lock sites, for the experts in the audience, that allow us to conditionally delete a key exon from the gene and create a null mutation. And we can do those crosses in a way that allow us to prevent the cell death that would normally occur. And so this is what an embryo looks like if you stain it with islet 1. And there's a lot of dots here. Those represent nuclei, and a lot of different cell types are labeled with islet 1. So it's not absolutely specific for motor neurons, but this group of cells right down here are the motor neurons. Out here are the dorsal root ganglia sensory neurons. They also express islet 1. And then up here are cells that are interneurons that express islet 1. And this just highlights the fact that no single limb factor is all that informative in terms of regulating cell fate. It usually occurs in combinations. So what we really wanted to test here was we wanted to alter the levels of islet 1 protein in cells. So in these hypomorphs, you can see that and I have to say the gain has really been cranked up on these images so that you can see them in a presentation. But what has happened is that the overall level of protein has been reduced in these cells, and these cells tend to express a little bit less protein than some of the others, and so
but Sam,
they disappear.
So is this hypomorph less than it? Why can't you just look at one head?
There's some kind of regulatory event that goes on in a het that we don't get half as much expression as in a wild type. They look completely normal to us, and they label the same as
the... Do you think this hypomorph is somewhere between 50 and 100% or somewhere between 25 and 50%?
Yeah, we've tried to quantify. We've done a lot of confocal scans of these things, and I can't remember off the top of my head how much less. if I had to ballpark it, I'd say maybe 50% less. And then here is the conditional mutant. We can get it down a little bit lower with a conditional mutant. So I can't give you, at least off the top of my head, an absolute estimate on how low we're getting the islet 1 protein in these cells. So what happens as you begin to reduce the level of islet 1 protein? Well, according to my model, I've argued that you need islet 1 to displace LHX3 off of the NLI. And so as we reduce the levels of islet 1, that should allow this simpler complex, the tetrameric complex with LHX3, to form. And that complex is, we've argued, involved in generating interneurons rather than motor neurons. And so the interneurons are labeled in red here with CHEX10, motor neurons in green with HB9. So as you begin to titrate down the levels of islet 1 with a hypomorph and the conditional knockout, you can see an increase in the ratio of red to green here. So we begin to generate, and it's quantified here, we begin to generate more interneurons at the expense of the motor neuron population. So this, I would say, is somewhat predictable according to what I've hypothesized. One little sidelight is that, in addition, if you want to really consider protein concentrations, there is a second closely related gene to islet 1, islet 2. It comes on a little bit after the islet 1 gene initially is expressed. But we have found that it has the same activity as islet 1. In other words, you can co-express it with LHX3 and trigger motor neurons. So we think in terms of this hexameric complex, it's really the sum total of islet 1 plus islet 2 that might be relevant in terms of getting the stoichiometries just right. And Myung also believes that because she's combined some of our islet 1 mutations with some of our islet 2 mutations, and has in effect created a graded series here of lots of motor neurons to lots of interneurons. So as the islet 1 levels in green here begin to drop off, she believes that she's shifting toward producing more of this tetrameric complex that has LHX3 in it, and that is able to drive the interneuron differentiation in this particular case.
Is IL-1 or IL-2 can complement their function?
Yes, so we haven't done the complex genetic experiment of knocking one gene into the other locus, but from these kinds of experiments, we know there's a so-called genetic interaction from the loss of function, and as I showed you on the last slide, when you express islet 1 together with LHX3, you trigger ectopic motor neurons, these cells right here. And the same occurs with islet 2. You trigger ectopic motor neurons, these cells here. So that's why we believe that what's relevant here is the sum total of the islet protein.
Binding sites and DNA between islet 1 and islet 2, they're similar.
Yeah, we haven't been quite that thorough and actually done the DNA binding studies, but we have every reason to think that they would be the same. The homeodomains are absolutely identical between islet 1 and islet 2. So it would be a pretty big surprise.
Can you change the subtype, like with time? First time it was they determined to be motor neuron with this transcription factor. Can you change it to interneuron or something? Or you change it before they decide to be?
Yeah, so how much plasticity exists in the system? So, you know, to a degree, we are using blunt force tools here in the sense that when we misexpress some of the proteins in the dorsal neural tube, what we're really doing is defeating some of the endogenous differentiation pathways with the factors that we're putting in. And that is might complicate things a bit, but at least it seems to work. But we don't think about it too often because we don't really have any clear thoughts about it. In terms of the plasticity, we don't think that once the neuron is postmitotic, that there's any plasticity that we'll be able to change its fate. So we try and introduce these constructs into the cells while they're still dividing, while they're likely to still be multipotential, because we know that there's a lot more plasticity at that stage. So just to reinforce this relatively simple idea, we think that the levels of the islet proteins, islet 1 and islet 2, relative to the LHX3 and NLI proteins, influence whether you make this tetrameric complex or this hexameric complex. and that this complex makes the V2 interneurons, and this complex makes the motor neurons that develop right adjacent to them in the neural tube. We think it's based primarily on protein affinities and relative concentrations. So I think everything that we have done suggests that you have to have enough of the islet proteins to displace off enough of the LHX3 so that you prevent this complex.
After that, so you already have some number of these complexes.
So after that, we know about a series of downstream events. One of them is, I've used as a marker, the HB9 transcription factor. The HB9 transcription factor within motor neurons, so this complex drives the expression of HB9. HB9 is a repressor for the genes that are activated here. So there are feedback loops that are that become activated to help ensure that the decision is doesn't waffle too much. Okay, so for years, my group has worked on this family of limb homeodomain factors. So the key here is limb and homeodomain. But there are a set of four genes that have only limb domains, so limb only or LMO factors. So these are the like redheaded stepchildren in the family that don't really give them a lot of respect. But more recently, we've started to think about, well, how do they actually fit into the system that we've been working on? Because we know they're expressed in the developing neural tube. And one of them in particular, the LMO4 gene, which is shown here, immunolabeling in red, is produced at quite high levels in the medial part of the neural tube, so the progenitor cells. What's a little bit hard to tell is that their LMO4 is also expressed by the motor neurons because we've double labeled the motor neurons with HB9 and green. But these cells really have both red and green in them. So the medial cells have LMO4 and motor neurons have LMO4. Now, we've kind of scratched our head over this observation because one of the models that has been argued with the limb-only factors is that they bind to NLI with similar affinities to the limb homeodomain factors. They ought to be displacing the limb homeodomain factors as drawn here, but we don't think that these ought to be able to regulate transcription because you lose half of your DNA binding component here. So it's been hard for us to account for why a negative regulator, presumably a negative regulator, might be found in motor neurons. And this is the point that I really want to hit on. How much time do I really have here?
You should finish in about 15 minutes.
Okay. I can do that. So I really want to focus our thoughts now on LMO4 and paradoxically why it might be advantageous for these neurons to express LMO4. So I just said that one of the models is that the LMO4 in effect acts as a dominant negative by displacing limb factors so they can't bind to DNA. But another popular model, at least for me, has been that maybe it has positive functions. Maybe the LMO4, which is in blue here, could serve as an adapter to recruit in other DNA binding components, other transcription factors. And that might allow you to generate asymmetric, novel kinds of transcription factor complexes. The attractive feature for me, and if this is true, is that it might allow you to integrate multiple differentiation pathways into one transcriptional complex that has a unique kind of DNA specificity. And there's a little bit of evidence for both of these models. So the work done in Drosophila would suggest that the homologs of the limb-only factors have this negative function. But there have been a variety of studies, especially in blood development, that have suggested that there are other classes of transcription factors. And I'm going to point out two of them in a moment. One of them is called SCL, and another one of them is called GATA2. That those transcription factors interact with pretty high affinity to LMO4. And so both of these models are a real possibility. The LMO4, I showed you briefly one example of its expression, but it's certainly in the right place at the right time to be participating in these kinds of complexes that are relevant for the generation for motor neurons and V2 interneurons.
Can the LMO4 interact with the C-terminal of LHX3?
No. So it's C-terminal of islet 1. So that interaction is really specific for the limb domain of LHX3 and the back end of islet 1. Yeah. So first the negative regulation. So there's good reason to believe that the LMO4s can displace limb homeodomain factors and negatively regulate their activity. So one of the lines of evidence is that if we set up transcription assays whereby the islet LHX3 complex is activating transcription and then we add in LMO4, that we reduce the level of transcription. We'll leave it at that. I could go into more detail on how the assay is actually set up. An additional aspect of this model is that there ought to be a competition between the LMO4 protein and islet 1 and NLI. And this is a model looking at, or a gel looking at protein interactions in which we first put in NLI and islet 1 and show that the NLI can pull down the islet 1 here. But then we add in LMO4, and the LMO4 begins to displace some of the islet 1 so that what you're supposed to appreciate is the fact that this band is less intense than that band, despite the fact that the input quantities of the islet protein are the same. So this would suggest that the LMO4 can compete for the binding that occurs between islet 1 and NLI, and that competition at least correlates with a reduction in the transcriptional activity of these complexes. This is a gain of function experiment which just reinforces this competition model. So what we have done is triggered ectopic motor neuron differentiation with these two transcription factors and presumably via this complex. We then added in LMO4. We think that this interaction begins to occur, and we've suppressed entirely the ability to generate these ectopic motor neurons. Now, one thing that we have in our prior publications glossed over, but I think is important, is the fact that we have a heck of a time killing the endogenous motor neuron population even when we express LMO4. And we can, this thing is deadly potent at inhibiting motor neuron differentiation of the ectopic cells formed up here. So we have to try and account for that in some of our models. If this negative interaction or this interaction between LMO4 and NLI shown in gray here is real, one prediction is that if we take this chimeric molecule I had described previously, the dimerization bit of NLI, the homeodomain of islet 1, the homeodomain of LHX3, which has activity when it comes to triggering ectopic motor neuron differentiation, that this ought to be resistant to the effects of the suppressive effects of LMO4. And so we co-express these things, and indeed we still get ectopic motor neurons. So it is resistant as you might predict from our model.
Is another way of saying that perhaps the complex that's already in motor neurons is, for whatever reason, infinitely stable or very, very stable?
Yes. And I'm going to try and show you a little bit of data that would support that. Yeah.
There is a parallel pathway.
Yes. Although we know from loss of function experiments that you absolutely require islet 1 and LHX3, so the parallel pathway seems to, if it does exist, depends on these factors and the activity of those factors. But you could argue that there's something different, a different set of interactions. That would be the alternative, yeah?
And if you put down LMO4 in motor neurons, you get another protein, so which might be a bait, and basically you don't mess up with the complex.
Possibly, yeah. Yeah. I should write these down, so come back to them. I'm going to show you more data here so you can help refine some of these thoughts. So this is a very busy slide here, but what it lays out, and I've now introduced for the first time the idea that you can actually generate two subtypes of interneurons, an A population and a B population. these are some of the transcription factors that are produced just as these cells are generated, and these are some of the predicted complexes that we think form. So I've told you this tetrameric complex is involved in V2 interneurons, but more specifically the V2A interneurons, and that this hexameric complex is involved in motor neurons. And I've also argued, at least in the context of motor neurons, that the presence of LMO4 likely acts as a competitor, and that this is seems to be a non-functional complex. I didn't show you data for this, but we have good data that suggests that the same holds in the V2A interneurons, that the LMO4 displaces some of the LHX3, and that this complex is non-functional in terms of triggering these interneurons, the differentiation of these interneurons. So the situation seems to be a little bit different in the V2B population. So I raised this alternative model with regard to LMOs, and that they could be adapter proteins that might recruit in additional factors. And two proteins that are known to have moderate, not I would say at the same level as the affinity between LMO4 and NLI, but moderate affinity, are transcription factor, zinc transcription factor, zinc finger transcription factor called GATA2, and another one, a BHLH factor called SCL. And both of these factors have been implicated in blood development, but they also are expressed in the developing spinal cord and specifically in the cells that are becoming V2B interneurons. And in this particular model, we think that what is happening is that a higher order complex with NLI at its center is recruiting these two different transcription factors using LMO4 as an adapter. And this is also kind of a busy slide, but let me see if I can find a couple of the key data points here that would... So if we co-express GATA2, for example, together with LMO4, we can generate ectopic V2B interneurons. So the LMO4 in solid purple here is ectopically expressed, and the yellow here is meant to represent GATA2, which is ectopically expressed, and presumably there's some endogenous SCL around that can help this complex assemble and trigger these V2B interneurons. You can switch it around and you can do SCL LMO4, that's over here. You don't get so many cells up in the dorsal part of the neural tube, but you get a few extra down here where the motor neurons would normally develop. And we think that the position of these ectopic cells may have something to do with, in this experiment we didn't put in SCL, in this experiment we didn't put in GATA2, so the complementary components may be localized and dictate where you get your ectopic cells. We've also done the experiment of fusing the dimerization domain of NLI to GATA2, and which is GATA2, the yellow one, GATA2 and SCL, and that's really quite effective at triggering ectopic V2B interneurons. So the point I guess I should make here is that rather than suppressing the ectopic generation of V2B interneurons, in either this case or this case, the LMO4 certainly doesn't suppress it and probably even helps to enhance it a little bit, which is in complete contrast to what's going on with the other complexes that I talked about. So I don't know if I explained that very well, but I'm going to present a model here of how you might generate these three different cell types. And the fact that LMO4 might have positive functions and negative functions. And then in the last minute or two, I'm going to talk about this idea where LMO4 has a hard time suppressing motor neuron generation in the endogenous population. So we think that there are interrelated higher order complexes that are involved in the generation of these three different cell types, and that you can switch from the V2A complex containing two LHX3 molecules to this motor neuron complex by adding in islet 1 and or islet 2 here in green. So you go from this tetramer to this hexamer. But that if you have high levels of LMO4 present, you begin to form something that may not be particularly functional with regard to generating motor neurons. But the presence of LMO4 probably has a cooperative effect in recruiting other factors like GATA2 and SCL that are generated, that are seem to be involved in generation of V2B interneurons. And so the interrelationship between all of these complexes means that the relative levels of these proteins probably do have a major influence in terms of dictating which one is assembled and in biasing you toward one of these three different cell fates. Now the question I want to come back to here quickly is, why would you bother in these cells to produce LMO4 if it's just going to interfere with either motor neuron or V2A interneuron generation? In thinking about this, we believe through some of our loss of function data with islet 1 that as you reduce the levels of islet protein, that you go from having a functional complex here to having a V2A interneuron kind of complex here. And that if we imagine that there, you need a certain amount of these complexes to get above a threshold level to activate the genes necessary for triggering, in this case, motor neuron differentiation, that if you were to have no LMO4, that you would require perhaps less islet protein to achieve this optimal ratio between the three components. But by adding in LMO4, because the LMO4 can begin to serve as a competitor, that it might force you to shift the curve to the right and force you to express more of the islet protein and probably more of the other components. Likewise, if you were to massively overexpress islet 1, we haven't done this experiment, but a prediction would be that you could get to a point where this wasn't particularly effective at regulating gene expression because you'd form a bunch of these islet NLI interactions, but the islet would also begin to interact with the LHX3, and you wouldn't be able to form this kind of complex. So we think that there would be a curve here, that an activity curve here, where there's an optimal level of all of the components, and at a certain point you cross over a threshold where it's sufficient to trigger motor neuron generation. So does any of this stand up in terms of the genetics? Well, we've knocked out the LMO4 gene, and we've compared it very carefully to controls, and counted cells like crazy at all kinds of different stages. We can't find any obvious difference in the number of motor neurons or V2 interneurons in the presence or absence of LMO4. So we've scratched our head over that for quite a while, wondering, well, does LMO4 really even have a function in these cells? So then we sensitized the system a little bit. We went to our islet 1 hypomorphs. So in these embryos, you'll remember that there are fewer motor neurons labeled in green here, more V2A interneurons labeled in red. And what you'll notice is that if we also eliminate LMO4 in this context, that now we get this a bounce back effect. We recover our motor neurons. So this would imply that the endogenous LMO4 in here, under conditions where islet 1 levels are quite low, is acting in a negative manner, and that by eliminating LMO4, we unmask the function of the low levels of islet 1 and allow it to be, again, become sufficient to generate motor neurons. So we have good functional reason or evidence to believe that the LMO4 is doing something, but under conditions where you have optimal protein concentrations, it's hard to unmask the function of LMO4. It's only under conditions where you begin to have reduced levels of islet 1.
And I don't understand why this experiment, did you use checks 10 as a marker for GATA3?
You get the same thing with GATA3. Yep. Then we discovered, I showed you some evidence that LMO4 can compete off islet 1 from its interaction with NLI, so we titrate in LMO4 here and you see the islet 1 signal getting weaker. But you may have not been wildly convinced that the competition was a great competition because we were comparing the level of intensity of this band to, for example, that band. What we found, however, is that the competition that we were doing was, in this case, done with a full-length NLI so that it could form dimers. And we were doing this in cells, so this isn't just all in a test tube. So there could be other interacting proteins here. So the full-length NLI, the LMO4 has a hard time competing off the islet 1. But if we take just the C-terminal end of islet NLI, the part that interacts with islet 1, as shown here, and do the same competition experiment, the LMO4 is a far better competitor. And a couple of possibilities. So I've argued that LMO4 can displace islet 1 and other components off of NLI, but maybe when you have a stable complex, the light gray circle here is meant to indicate that some additional interactions might take place that might make it more difficult for NLI to compete. And that some additional interactions in the fully stable form of the complex might make it resistant to the negative effects of LMO4. And so this is where I'm going to end.
So can islet 1 dimerize at high concentration?
Not with itself. Yeah. What were you thinking?
Because basically there are NLI put together to islet 1 and the...
Yeah, so, okay. So in solution, in the absence of any of these other factors, we don't have any evidence of islet 1 directly interacting with islet 1. But I wouldn't exclude the possibility that when some of these interactions start to occur, that there might be some interaction sites that are unmasked somehow. So it is possible that there would be some energy gain via islet 1, islet 1 interactions in the context of this complex.
Yeah, especially if DNA's.
Yeah. So in the first form of these curves that I showed you, I just argued that what LMO4 would do is basically shift your curve to the right a little bit, forcing you to produce a little bit more islet 1. But in the evidence that we've seen with LMO4, the genetics, what also seems to be going on is that LMO4 doesn't really seem to have what I would consider linear effects. And so we really only unmask its function when islet 1 levels are very low. And so one possibility, one model, or I don't know if it rises to the level of model just yet, perhaps cartoon or fanciful thought, is that at low islet levels, the LMO4 is quite an effective competitor, and that steepens the curve. But as you get to the proper stoichiometries of all of the components, that stabilizing interactions begin to occur, and now the LMO4 is less effective as a competitor. And so perhaps the reason that counterintuitively cells are expressing LMO4 is not just to simply force you to express more of the other components, but rather to change the shapes of the curves a little bit so that you get more abrupt transitions, so to speak. And one of the reasons it may be advantageous to have more abrupt transitions is, again, to help convert what are starting out as being relatively smooth gradients to absolute definitive decisions about I will become a motor neuron or I will become an interneuron, so that you don't get this clouded hybrid kind of identity. And so we think that LMO4 might actually be an important regulator in the whole system via its ability to perhaps modulate at under different stoichiometric conditions the output that is achieved with these limb complexes. And so with that...
I think what you were really talking about is sort of hysteresis in the
yes.
green curve, right? So
yes.
once if the IL-2 latched on, right, binds some other third factor,
right?
It becomes more stable and it's sort of hysteretic.
Right.
It's green.
That's right, yeah. This is just the idea. These are what the actual transcription boundaries look like. This is Sonic Hedgehog, the RNA, and the notochord in the floor plate. This is the protein. As you can see, there's no obvious gradient shooting up here. So it's difficult to detect that. But through lots of functional experiments, we think that there is a gradient. These, again, are the boundaries. You can see, you know, there's some green cells that are showing up kind of intermingled here. And so we think these things are going to sort out, and the boundaries will sharpen up here a bit. And I just the argument I've tried to make is that the LMO4 might be helping to sharpen up some of these boundaries as an additional layer of regulation.
Thank you.
And the people involved, I really talked about only one person's data today, Myeong Song, who now has her own lab in South Korea. These are the other members of my group. Some of our collaborators, I didn't get a chance to talk about our wonderful collaboration with Greg Lemke, a fantastic colleague of mine. Thanks very much for your attention.
Yeah, I'm just trying to, so a couple days ago we heard a talk by Mike Levine, who studied dorsal ventral Galerian ultrasound. And he had this analysis where the ventral side of the embryo, which responded to high dorsal levels, had certain promoter elements that were very good dorsal binding sites. Mm-hmm. While the genes that turned on in intermediate levels had less good dorsal binding sites, but a second transcription factor's binding site that at low levels could synergize and give you a new response.
Right.
And he would try to correlate the promoters of these.
Right.
There was some correlation, basically, the strain and order.
So that... did I interrupt
you?
Is
that the same or different of what you... I mean, you were just not saying with promoters, binding sites, but with complexes, but is it the
We've done some work on the promoter end of things as well to convince ourselves that some of these cartoons are not entirely made up. And there are clear examples of synergistic interactions that tie together some of the functions of these different transcription factor complexes. And one way that we think about it is that the limb complexes that I was drawing for you with regard to motor neurons, they don't in and of themselves have a really high level of transcription activating potential. But they synergize with VHLH transcription factors, which have separate DNA binding sites, which also are involved in the generic process of triggering neurogenesis. And by linking the activity and the function of those two classes of factors, we think that that helps to link factors that are involved in establishing cell identity or neuronal subtype identity, in this case motor neurons, with ones that are intimately involved with the generic process of specifying a neuron from a neural epithelial cell. So, as to back up, there is very good evidence to suggest that these promoters are complex units that integrate multiple transcription complexes, and obviously the genes use that to their advantage to extract more specific information from factors that are showing up in all kinds of different cellular contexts.
So just to, for people who aren't necessarily good, so there are some proteins, some genes, which are turned on dorsal ventrally in the system over fairly substantial domains. They don't go all the way to the top membrane, but they go pretty far. But one of the things that I think actually Mike mentioned this during his talk, but the actual regulation of that gradient, of the dorsal gradient in the Drosophila embryo, is actually mostly not a regulation of turning on the gene.
Yeah.
It's controlling where the protein is in the cell. So the gradient is really a gradient of localization of the dorsal protein into the nucleus in the ventral part of the Drosophila embryo.
Yeah.
It really wasn't, I think he skipped over this. I mean, that's the key aspect of that story. And the signaling pathway, the Toll pathway, actually controls that. Mm-hmm. Controls whether or not
you
shuttle in or out of the nucleus. The protein can't do its job if it's not in the nucleus. So it's different from that.
Is there any regulated degradation of these components of complexes? Because that would be a way to deal with supernatural.
Yes. So the implication has been that there are ring finger proteins that can interact with pretty high affinity to some of the components within these complexes. And the thought is that there is likely to be a ring degradation. What regulates it, what controls the timing, none of that is very well understood. But simply from looking at tissue sections and thinking a little bit about the timing, the transitions from having one set of transcription factor complexes, in this case here in the progenitor cells, to the next, is really pretty rapid in some cases. And so it's highly likely that these transitions are regulated by a whole secondary system that you're alluding to of eliminating components. And certainly as you generate some of these kind of initial interneuron and motor neuron types, then over time you generate subclasses of those cells, and the transcription codes change radically from the things that I was describing. And so I think it is very likely that protein degradation is another part of how the system controls gene expression.
I was simply thinking that for the stereochemistry, that if they're floating around,
unbound components that could be eliminated so that you don't. That's right. If we had good assays, it would be interesting if we could tweak, upregulate one of the components and find out whether that tended to target it for degradation, because we've thrown this sub geometry off. So
okay, thanks again, Sam.
So that's a